Primal Leadership by Daniel Goleman, Richard Boyatzis, and Annie McKee. Continued, Cassette 4, Side 2. He made plans with each employee to meet outside of work in an informal setting where the employees might be more comfortable revealing where they hoped to go in life. Trevino also looked for areas outside his job where he could sharpen his empathy and coaching skills. For example, by coaching his daughter's soccer team and volunteering at a local crisis center for families in trouble. Both activities offered an arena to experiment with how well he understood others and to try out new coaching skills. These new arenas allowed him to stay more attentive, more mindful of his learning goals. It's like getting a new pair of glasses. It gives one a new set of lenses through which to see the world and allows one the chance to become more sensitive to situations where one needs to improve. In fact, the more parts of our lives that we can identify as relevant to a leadership learning goal, the more chances to practice we give ourselves. A study conducted at the Weatherhead School of Management of Case Western Reserve University by Professor Jane Wheeler found that of people who had developed learning agendas, those who tried out their new skills with many different people and spheres of their lives, not just at work, but also with family, church, and community groups, and so on, improved the most. And those improvements were still apparent up to 2 or more years later. Being mindful of learning opportunities when they arise and spontaneously seizing them as a way to practice new abilities offers ways to improve more quickly. Life is the laboratory for learning. It's important to bear in mind that plans that tend to simply focus on specific performance goals are less effective than those drawn from comparing your ideal self with your real self. The third discovery, a learning agenda. Too often, leadership coaching revolves around a performance improvement plan, a phrase that conjures images of a remedial rehabilitation project. But rather than being some rote exercise that will fix a person into being a better leader, learning goals should resonate with a person's dreams. Because a performance agenda focuses on achieving some measure of success, it becomes something a person has to prove. It can provoke defensiveness. Such agendas don't capture the motivating aspect of how one's personal dreams might coincide with the target, an aspect that can be highly motivating. A learning agenda, however, focuses on the possibility of change that will eventually lead to better performance at work and probably more contentment in life in general. Small wonder that improvement plans crafted around learning rather than performance outcomes have been found most effective. For instance, in a program to improve communication skills, a learning agenda resulted in dramatically better presentations. A performance agenda tended to make people react defensively, not wanting to look bad, while neglecting to give them concrete steps to improve their actual performance. The best kind of learning agenda helps you focus on what you want to become, your own ideal, rather than on someone else's idea of what you should be. It should lead to setting meaningful standards of performance rather than taking on an arbitrary normative standard for success that may or may not fit with personal goals. When crafting specific manageable learning goals, it works best to tie them into goals that motivate you and ignite your full range of talents. On the other hand, being handed a performance goal tends to do the opposite. It undermines motivation by evoking anxiety and doubts about whether or not one can improve, and so it does not necessarily increase performance. For example, even in the goal-driven arena of sales, learning goals have been shown to lead to greater improvement than have performance goals. Setting developmental goals that matter takes us from merely contemplating change to making concrete steps that prepare us to change. Our learning goals are a kind of mental rehearsal that pave the way for a change in how we act. The Mindful Prefrontal Cortex. As we saw with Juan Trevino, crafting an agenda of specific goals converts life into a learning lab. Spending time with his daughter's soccer team at a crisis center and with colleagues from work, all became opportunities for Trevino to work on his emotional intelligence. The goals helped him to monitor himself, to see how well he was doing. They reminded him to pay attention. Since the habits he was trying to overcome had become automatic, routines that had taken hold over time without his realizing it, bringing them into awareness was a crucial step toward changing them. As he paid more attention, the situations that arose, whether while listening to a colleague, coaching soccer, or talking on the phone to someone who was distraught, all became cues that stimulated him to break old habits and try new responses instead. This cueing for habit change is neural as well as perceptual. Researchers at the University of Pittsburgh and Carnegie Mellon University have shown that as people mentally prepare for a task, they activate the prefrontal cortex, that part of the brain that performs executive functions and moves them into action. Without preparation, the prefrontal cortex does not activate in advance. Thus, the greater the prior activation, the better a person does at the task. Such mental rehearsal becomes particularly important when we're trying to overcome old leadership habits and replace them with a better way of doing things. As one of the neuroscientists in this study found, the prefrontal cortex becomes particularly active when a person has to prepare to overcome a habitual response. The aroused prefrontal cortex marks the brain's focus on what's about to happen. Without that arousal, a person will act out old, undesirable routines. The executive who just doesn't listen will once again cut off his subordinate. The pace setter will launch into yet another overly critical attack. Because leadership skills are part of an unconscious repertoire of habits learned long ago, the old response won't magically disappear. It takes commitment and constant reminders to stay focused on undoing those habits. Over time, the need for reminders will diminish as the new behavior becomes a stronger pathway in the brain. Goal setting, a new perspective. Setting goals and creating plans to achieve them is nothing new. Benjamin Franklin outlined a step-by-step process for becoming a virtuous person through setting daily and weekly goals to increase admirable behavior. But research has clearly shown that there is a science to this process. In the 1960s, David McClelland of Harvard University showed that setting specific goals and developing a plan to achieve them made entrepreneurs more successful. David Kolb, a former student of McClelland's, later did a series of studies at MIT that pinpointed which parts of the process of goal setting were essential for improvements to occur. Managers are all too familiar with goal setting these days. Not only do they have to plan their own days and set agendas for meeting annual performance targets, but they also have to do the same with each of their direct reports. Additionally, they participate in planning at the strategic business unit, division, and corporate level. And they've been inundated with tools with which to make those plans, from daily activity planning books to electronic Palm Pilots. No wonder managers complain of having to spend too much time planning, with few moments left over to do the actual work. With all of this planning frenzy, what new information or tools could possibly be of use? Recent studies of people who have improved their emotional intelligence reveal several key points about what works and what doesn't. Although some may seem obvious, even common sense, they are not common practice. The findings include the following. Goals should build on one's strengths, not on one's weaknesses. Goals must be a person's own, not goals that someone else has imposed. Plans should flexibly allow people to prepare for the future in different ways. A single planning method imposed by an organization will often prove counterproductive. Plans must be feasible with manageable steps. Plans that don't fit smoothly into a person's life and work will likely be dropped within a few weeks or months. Plans that don't suit a person's learning style will prove demotivating and quickly lose his attention. Let's now look at how each of those points would modify goal setting as we typically know it. Goals should build on strengths. Demetrius, the president of a fast-growing, research-based consulting firm, was an effective democratic leader. He rated high on his levels of self-awareness and social awareness, and had competencies in building bonds, teamwork, and developing others. Using his talent for drawing out ideas from others, he led the company through a very tough period into one of expanding market share. But once the company had clearly succeeded, Demetrius faced a leadership dilemma. The firm's partners and staff started wondering where the company was going next. They wanted visionary leadership and someone ready to make the tough decisions about priorities that would maintain their growth momentum. Demetrius's democratic style felt too laissez-faire. It threatened to allow the partners to take parts of the company in any direction they wished, which could tear the company to pieces. Demetrius's subsequent work with an executive coach offers a good lesson in how learning goals can address a gap while building on strengths. Together, they uncovered telling gaps in Demetrius's style, where he lacked the more assertive push uses of power, such as competencies in influence and conflict management. The coach helped Demetrius see that the inspirational leadership and change catalyst competencies he often used with clients were left at the door when he came into the office. To build his visionary leadership strengths inside the company, Demetrius decided on a novel learning goal: to treat his company as if it were his most important client. He would use his strengths in social awareness to understand each challenge that emerged within the company as though it were a client's problem. His action plan included thinking through how this new client, his own organization, should approach problems. He even took on the task of writing a consulting memo to himself each day in which he proposed specific solutions. His second learning goal dealt with a leadership crisis. He aimed to be inspiring at every company meeting. For example, he made sure he began each small group meeting with a reminder of why they were in business, their vision, values, and mission. Although at first he felt a bit self-conscious, even awkward, as he persisted in cultivating new habits of the visionary style, it soon felt less gushy and more natural. Here he built on two strengths: his talent at being inspirational with clients and his teamwork skills. For example, when he would mention the company's mission at the beginning of a meeting, he was then able to go one step further and elicit from the group their collaborative ideas for the company's vision as well. By calling on his strengths, Demetrius was able to pursue his learning plan with confidence. He knew that he'd already done for clients what he needed to do for his own company. The company more than tripled its revenue in the next 6 years. In addition to building on strengths to change his leadership style, Demetrius chose to develop competencies already close to the tipping point, the level at which a relatively small improvement or increase in the frequency of a competence will tip someone into outstanding performance. David McClelland was the first researcher to apply tipping point analysis to competencies. Prior research had answered the question, what competencies are necessary to be outstanding? This new approach answered the question, how much of the competencies are sufficient to become outstanding? In Demetrius's case, he had two competency gaps close to the tipping point: the ability to offer inspirational leadership and to be a change catalyst, and two competency gaps distant from the tipping point: skills in influencing people and in conflict management. If his learning goal had been to develop a vision on his own or with a small group of partners and then to sell it to the staff, he'd have had to really fortify his weaknesses in the influence and conflict management competencies. But by working on creating new habits closer to his current style, he was more likely to succeed at building an effective visionary leadership style. Are they really your goals? When Mark Scott, Vice President of Public Relations at a mortgage bank, reflected on how he'd changed after a leadership development program, he described three improvements. He felt more understanding of people from diverse backgrounds, more able to build effective working relationships with the wide variety of people, and more flexible in new and uncertain situations. These gains reflected the first three learning goals in the agenda he'd developed 2 years before. But when asked what happened to the fourth and fifth goals in his plan, he needed to be reminded of what they were. "Oh, those were my boss's goals," he said. "She insisted that a good learning plan should address all of the gaps that appeared in my assessments." Clearly, someone else's idea of what he should do didn't resonate with Scott. But that kind of misfire happens frequently in goal setting. People agree to development goals because a boss, mentor, coach, or spouse encourages or pushes them to change. But it's important to remember that the more personal the commitment to learning goals, the more likely you are to achieve them. This is where passion and hope, the motivating brain activity inherent in tapping into your dreams, are again so vital to sustainable learning. And the more difficult a goal, the more essential is one's commitment. How do you think about the future? I've never set a goal for myself, not for my career or my personal life. But I've always known that whatever I do, it will be in line with what I feel is important. So says an entrepreneur in response to our questions about how he plans for the future. The sole owner of a consulting firm, he's quite successful by anyone's measure, likewise in his personal life. He plans his future based on a very clear sense of what's important to him, his values, his beliefs, the way he wants to live his life. He has charted a path for himself that doesn't have specific mileposts, such as a particular job. It does, however, have guideposts that he uses when making life decisions, and he relies on a high level of self-awareness and a knack for spotting good opportunities. Contrast that entrepreneur's approach with that of Denise Cesar, CEO of Blue Cross of Northeastern Pennsylvania. Since she was young, Cesar has always had clear, specific goals and a vision of where she would end up. She says, "Public accounting is an up-or-out profession. So when I entered it, the obvious goal was to become a partner. Then, when I entered healthcare, I saw myself at the top of a company someday. I focused on where I wanted to be, kept my sense of humor, stayed clear about my values, and moved toward my goal one step at a time." And that's exactly what she did. At each juncture, she worked through the path to success for that particular portion of her career, always with an eye on the goal. She's adept at reading her environment, oriented toward achievement, and knows how to manage the ups and downs of change. At the opposite end of the spectrum are people who don't consider the future at all, at least not in the way we normally view such planning. They create the future as they go along, almost rebelliously holding on to the right to do what they please. "I don't want to waste my time worrying about what's next," says a leader of a consumer goods company. That doesn't mean that he doesn't achieve success in both his personal and professional life, but he tends to think more about success in terms of the present moment, allowing his understanding of current dynamics to guide his behavior. There is no right way, then, to plan for the future. Research has shown that it's a very personal process. When people do try to follow a prescribed model, their learning plans usually get relegated to the bottom drawer. One size does not fit all when it comes to formulating a useful agenda for your future. That said, we've found that within each of the planning styles that people use are competencies worth learning. Directional or visionary planners, for example, are good at crafting a picture of a meaningful, distant future state, one that's grounded in values, beliefs, and a deep sense of what's important in life. Goal-oriented planners get what they go after. Social science research tells us that specific, measurable goals are more likely to be achieved. Knowing how to set such goals can help people focus their energy where and when it's needed. Action orientation, on the other hand, results in a high level of accomplishment in the short term. Moreover, the freedom inherent in such planning adds an element of serendipity that enhances creativity. Finally, though it is tempting to ignore it, the shoulds of reflective planning are a fact of life for most people anyway, so it's best to factor that in to how to think about the future. Plans must be feasible. Perhaps the greatest mistake that people make when setting goals is committing themselves to activities that are difficult to do in their current lives and work style. Your action plan needs to fit into the structure and rhythm of your life. We saw in previous chapters how improvements last longer when people identify specific emotional intelligence competencies as part of their learning goals, rather than setting a vague target. Even aiming at just one goal for improvement can yield dramatic jumps in effectiveness. Learning plans that lay out concrete, practical steps yield the most powerful improvement. For instance, people who have tried to improve their ability as speakers, a key to a leader's communications and vital to many competencies, have set some of the following concrete goals for themselves. Give at least 2 formal presentations every month and have them critiqued by a peer I respect. Practice with a friend before giving a presentation. Videotape myself giving a speech and critique it with my boss's help. Join Toastmasters so I can practice giving more effective talks. Talk to people who give oral presentations in a manner that comes across as relaxed and interesting, and find out what they do to prepare, specifically how they overcome stage fright and relax into the presentation. Which of these goals will work for a given person depends on the realities of his life. To work on a development goal, it must be squeezed into an already crowded schedule. And since action steps do often take additional time in our lives, the question becomes, what will you say no to in order to create the time you need for working on the goal? The alternative is to design your steps so that they're integral to what you do already. For instance, instead of joining a group in which to practice giving presentations, one mid-level manager we know made a daily staff meeting her micro-platform. She gave herself more ways to practice by taking on assignments that arose which offered the opportunity to present reports to the rest of the group. She thereby integrated her learning into each day, using her work setting as a laboratory for strengthening her leadership skills. Know your learning style. Most leaders have a preferred way to learn, a mode that feels most natural. Rather than fighting that learning style or trying to conform to an imposed style, it makes sense to leverage your preferred style. Take, for example, 2 friends, both of whom became CEOs within a few years, who decided to learn to sail one summer. One went out and bought a 12-foot dinghy with which he planned to practice during a month on the coast of Maine. At the same time, his friend enrolled in a sailing course in Boston Harbor. On the first day, as the new owner of the dinghy was pushing off the beach in Maine, his friend was sitting in a classroom learning the principles of sailing. But once he developed a theoretical comfort with sailing, he was able to start sailing large boats right from the beginning. Meanwhile, off the coast of Maine, his friend was out in the water from day one, albeit in a small boat, and discovering on his own things like why a centerboard is useful. In the ensuing years, he practiced his newfound skills in larger and larger boats. In the end, each friend learned the skill he desired, but in radically different ways from one another. The dinghy owner preferred learning through concrete experience, while his friend learned better by first building his own mental model of sailing. Fortunately for both of these novice sailors, each of them had the ability to also learn, when they had to, from active experimentation. Research has shown that people actually learn best when they use modes that suit them. The Learning Style Inventory, developed by David Kolb when he was at MIT, has been used for more than 30 years to understand learning in management, as well as in fields ranging from medicine to law. Kolb found that people learn most often through one of the following modes. Concrete experience, having an experience that allows them to see and feel what it is like. Reflection, thinking about their own and others' experiences. Model building, coming up with a theory that makes sense of what they observe. Trial and error learning, trying something out by actively experimenting with a new approach. Learning often happens best through some combination of two or three of these modes. On the other hand, some people rely on styles that can actually hinder their learning, especially if used too early or too much. Such learning styles turn people off to further learning or drain their excitement because they make learning feel boring or irrelevant. Many leaders, for instance, have had instruction at some point in leading teams more effectively. If they took the course from a college professor, they might have started with a few classes devoted to understanding the theory of group formation and group development. They might have had a class addressing the different philosophical perspectives about groups and teams. Meanwhile, rather than theory, what they might have really needed was a tool to use on Monday morning when they had to quiet down a disruptive team member. So, after a few classes, they might have felt the course was irrelevant and stopped paying attention. Professors organize courses to fit their own preferred learning style, which for academics is typically abstract and reflective. But a leader whose learning style may be more active and concrete needs to begin by learning some practical techniques he can try immediately. Too often, leadership courses and workshops present a fixed, cookie-cutter agenda. To avoid this pitfall in learning, it pays to identify your best learning styles to ensure that your action steps won't be wasted. If you can't identify your styles after a bit of reflection, there are simple tests that can help. To recap, by entering into the first three discoveries of self-directed learning, it is possible to develop an engaging but realistic agenda that can help you reach your leadership goals. You have compared your ideal vision with the reality of your style and behavior, and you've used that to identify your strengths and gaps. Then, with that profile in mind, you've targeted specific leadership abilities in a learning plan, setting a practical course to strengthen them. You begin the process of the final two discoveries when your agenda and the steps leading up to it has prepared and focused your attention on what to do. Now you try it and discover how to make this kind of learning a continuous part of your life as a leader. The fourth discovery, reconfiguring the brain. Jack was head of marketing for a division of a global food company. High energy and driven to improve results, Jack was a classic pace setter. He was always striving to find better ways to do things, and too eager to step in to take over when someone seemed about to miss a deadline. Worse, Jack was prone to pounce on anyone who didn't appear to meet his standards, flying into a rage whenever someone deviated from Jack's way of doing things. As his direct reports complained behind his back, Jack was a control freak. In our survey of his direct reports, we found the usual disastrous impact on climate. People were clear about the vision, where they needed to go, but not on how to get there. Jack knew what he wanted people to do, but failed to let them know when they were doing it right, giving no positive performance feedback. One result was a paralysis. People felt they had no flexibility to do their jobs in the way that made sense to them, but rather had to guess how Jack wanted them to do it. No surprise that in the 2 years since Jack had taken over the division, its business results had stalled. On the suggestion of his boss, Jack sought out a coach. The first step was to get an accurate diagnosis of Jack's strengths and limitations through a 360-degree evaluation on the emotional intelligence competencies. He knew his strengths: self-confidence, high energy, achievement orientation, initiative, and conscientiousness. For Jack, the most revealing data were the large gaps between his self-evaluation and how his direct reports rated him on two leadership competencies: self-control and empathy. To assist Jack in crafting a learning plan that could develop his skills in those two areas, Jack's coach spent a good deal of time at first simply helping him to digest the feedback data. The coach tied the reports of weak self-control and empathy to two of Jack's particular strengths: his ability to quickly see alternative solutions and his passionate desire to fix things immediately. Because Jack overused those strengths, he consequently underused more positive leadership styles, such as visionary and coaching styles, which rely on self-control and empathy. Once Jack saw how his weaknesses were keeping him back from his ideal vision of himself as an effective leader, he was able to zero in on what he needed to improve. He then committed himself to shifting the balance between his strengths and gaps, and his coach helped him work up a learning plan. The plan emphasized specific ways to use on-the-job, day-to-day events as the laboratory for learning. For example, Jack saw that he had no problem empathizing with people when things were calm, but once he began to feel stress, he'd tune out other people completely. That lack of self-control sabotaged his ability to listen to what people were telling him in the very moments he most needed to do so. Jack's learning plan, therefore, focused on handling emotions effectively. His coach showed Jack a method to tune in to the sensations in his body so he could monitor himself for early warning signs that he was about to fly off the handle again. Whenever he started to feel upset, he had four specific steps to take. 1. Step back. Listen, don't jump in. 2. Let the other person speak. 3. Get some objectivity. Ask yourself, is there a sound reason for my reaction, or am I jumping to conclusions? 4. Ask clarifying questions rather than ones that sound judgmental or hostile. This intentional change in Jack's typical overreaction response allowed him to empathize and listen, to gather information more fully and understand it more clearly, and to have a rational dialogue instead of launching into a harangue. He didn't have to agree with the other person, but now he gave that person a chance to make his case. Still, to make those changes, Jack had to learn to notice potentially problematic situations in the first place. By being alert to situations that in the past have triggered our old dysfunctional leadership habits, we're better able to choose a new, more positive reaction. Like an early warning radar, this anticipation signals us that we should pay more attention to what we are about to do, and so puts our next action in the realm of conscious choice. It gives us the chance to practice rather than missing yet another opportunity to change. Jack did practice his new behaviors again and again. He gave his direct reports more positive feedback on work well done, rather than merely criticizing them. He reminded them that what they did contributed to the group's mission, and he restrained himself from micromanaging how they got their work done. Little by little, he became more of a visionary and coaching leader. Over a 6-month period, Jack made real progress. His own records showed he'd reduced his number of flare-ups from one or more a day to just one or two a month. The climate in the division had improved sharply, and its numbers were starting to creep upward at last. A new model of learning. When a leader like Jack takes stock of his repertoire of leadership skills, in a sense, he is assessing the sum total of a lifetime of learning. The lessons people get in leadership start very early in life, from observing teachers, coaches, clergy, anyone who has been in the role of leader in their lives. These models offer the first scaffold for people's own leadership habits, their original ideas about what a leader does. Then, as they begin to step into their first leadership roles in clubs, teams, student government, or as leaders in their peer groups, they put those models into practice. In their jobs, they encounter new leaders and try out new leadership behaviors, adding on to that early initial scaffolding that they had built. Virtually none of these lessons involves explicit instruction in elements of leadership. They arise naturally in the course of life, but they lay down the brain circuitry for leadership habits, determining what a person will automatically tend to do in similar situations throughout life. Each time an individual heads a team, for instance, he'll most readily repeat what he did before as a team leader, and each time he repeats it, the neural connections for that habit become stronger. Cognitive scientists call such automatic strengthening of a habit implicit learning, as opposed to the explicit variety provided in school courses. For the most part, the brain masters the competencies of leadership, everything from self-confidence and emotional self-management to empathy and persuasion, through implicit learning. You'll recall that implicit learning occurs not in the topmost layers of the neocortex, the thinking brain, but rather toward the bottom of the brain, in the basal ganglia. In the case of leadership, that learning occurs presumably through connections to the prefrontal limbic circuits of emotional intelligence. This primitive section of the brain picks up and masters the habits we constantly rely on, continually learning how to perform the basic tasks of our lives, everything from stringing a sentence together to running an effective meeting. All this learning goes on tacitly, most of the time, without people even being aware that they are mastering such lessons, in what amounts to stealth learning. It's an elegant system, for the most part. The problem, though, is that people pick up their leadership habits rather haphazardly over the course of life, through repeating what they see their models do, or through repeating their own attempts at leading. If that first manager who so impressed one was a frantic pace setter, then that may become the model emulated as a leader. If he was a superb coach, what one will learn follows quite a different route. The net result? People end up with a mixed bag of leadership skills, akin to having mastered a few golf strokes, but being a terrible putter. Still, as we've seen, it's possible to improve if you do three things: bring bad habits into awareness, consciously practice a better way, and rehearse that new behavior at every opportunity until it becomes automatic. That is, until mastery has occurred at the level of implicit learning. Improving an emotional intelligence competence takes months rather than days, because the emotional centers of the brain are involved, not just the neocortex, the thinking brain, where technical skills and purely cognitive abilities are learned. As we've mentioned before, the neocortex learns very quickly, even on a first hearing, but the basal ganglia and its links to the emotional centers learn differently. To master a new skill, they need repetition and practice. That's why it's hard to learn leadership abilities effectively in a classroom. A teacher can't instruct your brain circuits that carry old habits of leadership to relearn new habits. What's needed is practice. The more often a behavioral sequence repeats, the stronger the underlying brain circuits become. People thereby literally rewire their brains. Learning new habits strengthens pathways between neurons and may even foster neurogenesis, growth of new neurons. For example, to overcome his pace-setting habit and broaden his leadership repertoire, Jack will have to practice repeatedly. The more settings in which he practices these new ways of thinking, feeling, and acting, the more flexible and strong the new circuits will become. At that point, someone like Jack would find himself going through the paces of leadership, effortlessly controlling his emotional reactions while listening with empathy. This marks the moment the new neural pathways have become the brain's default option. And that level of mastery lasts for years, if not an entire lifetime. All performance, no practice. Jack wouldn't have gotten far in developing his coaching style, however, without trying new ways of acting, particularly pausing to listen and ask questions. It was not easy. When a problem arose, every muscle in his body prepared for him to jump in, take over, and try to solve the problem himself. For Jack, that tendency was as automatic as knowing how to ride a bicycle, a reaction every bit as unconscious and powerful. That's why experimentation with more positive alternatives is crucial. The new way of thinking, feeling, or acting feels unnatural at first, something like putting on someone else's clothes. At the neural level, a person is forcing the brain to go along a path less traveled. Small wonder that Jack was filled with self-doubt during the first week or so he was trying to listen to others, rather than jumping in and taking over. It just didn't feel natural at first. Great athletes spend a lot of time practicing and a little time performing, while executives spend no time practicing and all of their time performing, as Jim Lehrer and Tony Schwartz observed in the Harvard Business Review. No wonder leaders so often recycle their problems. In the rush to achieve their goals and complete their tasks, they short themselves on learning to lead better. Often a leader will try a new approach once or twice and then apply it without giving himself the chance to practice it. The key to learning new habits for leaders lies in practice to the point of mastery. Otherwise, they invite a relapse, a return to old habits. If you've ever played a musical instrument, you know that when you rehearsed your sheet music just enough so you made no mistakes, you were practicing to the point of comfort. You could wing it when playing for your teacher, but under the stress of a recital, you might forget parts of the piece. Professional musicians, however, go a crucial step further. They rehearse and rehearse, and then rehearse some more. They practice until the fingering of their instrument or breathing is automatic. They practice until they can play it without thinking about it and can just feel it. Similarly, to master a leadership skill, you need to change the brain's default option by breaking old habits and learning new ones, which requires an extended period of practice to create the new neural pathway and then strengthen it. You know that the new habit has been mastered when you're able to sustain that new response long into the future, not just for a week or a month. The self-regulation competencies, particularly emotional self-control, may require special effort at first to get to the point of mastery. Some research suggests that managing emotional impulses is real mental work. The stress of the intentional effort to alter one's mood can deplete the energy it takes for self-control. Still, sometimes self-control is the very thing that's needed when practicing a new leadership style. Say, when a leader like Jack tries to master his pace-setting or commanding urges and replace them with a more affiliative style. In that case, learning requires a special effort, holding back the tendencies to react in the old way. A person has to override his emotional impulses, which adds to the burden of learning and can make him lose his focus. This suggests a learning strategy that at first focuses a bit more on overcoming the impulsive leadership habits you were trying to undo, before giving full attention to the new habits with which you want to replace the old. Eventually, by practicing self-control to the point of mastery, what was once an effort becomes automatic, taking the pressure off. Once you've taken this key step, then your mental energy and attention are freed up for practicing new modes of leadership. Stealth learning. While much, if not most, typical leadership development takes place in seminars, during a weekend or maybe even over a week of off-site training, that time frame hardly begins the process. So rather than, say, just going off to some kind of weekend sensitivity training program to hone his empathy, Jack used naturally occurring situations at work with his subordinates and peers as his training arena. He also talked about his learning plan with his wife and enlisted her as an informal coach to help him become a better listener at home and with friends. By expanding his learning arena in this way, Jack leveraged more from his life activities and maximized his learning efficiency. The trick is to learn while doing other things, a strategy that might be thought of as stealth learning, and that can be useful for improving emotional intelligence abilities, particularly leadership skills. In studying outstanding managers among scientists and engineers, those who, for example, regularly used competencies such as empathy, researcher Christine Dreyfus found that they had refined those talents in many settings. Their abilities were particularly impressive, given that they were engineers working in a technological culture that didn't often model those competencies. As described in Chapter 6, for outstanding leaders at Johnson & Johnson, most of the leaders Dreyfus studied had started experimenting with the skills as much as 40 years earlier in childhood activities such as the Boy Scouts. Then, in high school and college, they used sports, clubs, music groups, and dorm life to experiment further. Later, when they became bench scientists and engineers, working on problems in relative isolation, they continued to learn and refine these abilities in activities outside of work, practicing team building in settings such as church and community organizations, or by planning conferences for professional associations. The normal pace-setting brusqueness of the engineering culture softened as they experienced other, more relationship-oriented milieus. One engineer, for example, who'd become a strong leader, reported that he'd been able to transcend the command-and-control, pace-setting engineering culture through a somewhat surprising venue for leadership development, his church. This book is continued on Cassette 5, Side 1.